1991, Kurt Vonnegut published a collection of essays and speeches in this book under the title Fate's Worse Than Death. Among the ones he included in here was a talk he gave at the annual General Assembly of the Unitarian Universalist Association back in 1986. It was held in Rochester, New York. Vonnegut was our Ware lecturer for that year. The Ware lecture is kind of like a celebrity event at our General Assemblies, where they usually bring in a person who has a name recognition, a profile a little higher than within the general UU congregation. Well, Vonnegut, as I say, included his Ware lecture talk in this book, and he introduced it in the text, I mean, not at the GA, but he introduced his in this book by saying this. In order not to seem a spiritual quadriplegic to strangers trying to get a fix on me, I sometimes say I'm a Unitarian Universalist. So that denomination claims me as one of their own. It honored me by having me deliver a lecture at a gathering in Rochester, New York. And it goes on. So there you are. Among the various roles our liberal faith has played and accomplished in a larger American society, we have saved one of our country's more prominent novelists and essayists from the fate of being a spiritual quadriplegic. And who knows, maybe Vonnegut considered the absence of a spiritual component to one's life as indeed a fate worse than death. Some of his writings do seem to suggest that, even though he was an avowed atheist throughout his life. Was an avowed atheist throughout his life. It sounds a little strange to say that. For I've made numerous references to Mr. Vonnegut and his works in this pulpit over the years, as some of you probably recognize. This is the first time I have had to refer to his life in the past tense. He died this past April 11th at the age of 84. I've been out of the pulpit here for the past couple of Sundays with a youth group, and then with Tess George doing her fine service last Sunday. I didn't want to let the time get by without paying some kind of a tribute to him, because he has had a marked influence on my life, my ministry, just kind of the way I generally look at things. It was also of interest for me to note that Vonnegut and another of my literary heroes, as you know, Jack Kerouac, were born in the same year, 1922. Kerouac, thanks largely to a very tragically self-destructive lifestyle, died nearly 40 years ago, and has long been relegated, rightly or wrongly, to another era. Vonnegut, on the other hand, remained remarkably contemporary, right up to his death, as I say, just a little over 3 weeks ago. My one and only encounter with Mr. Vonnegut was at that same General Assembly that I just mentioned. On the campus there, it was held at the University of Rochester, which was just a few blocks over from the theological school I attended in the late 1960s, which was when I first discovered Vonnegut's writings. So there was something of an effect of closing a circle, of actually meeting him in person in the place where I had, near the place where I had first encountered him through his writings. Vonnegut had just published his novel, this one, Galapagos, at that time, and he did a signing at the U of R Student Union just before his, or a little before his Ware lecture. I waited patiently in a long line with my newly purchased copy of his newly published novel. When I finally got up to the table where he was signing, I thanked him for providing me with a lot of sermon material over the years. His response was to look up at me and raise one eyebrow slightly and say, "Well, that stuff's all copyright, you know." Yeah, I know. So just to keep this sermon on the up and up, all literary references herefore, henceforth, made this morning to this pulpit, unless otherwise noted, come to you courtesy of Kurt Vonnegut and his public. All right. When he asked if I wanted anything written on the inscription, to write anything besides his signature, I asked that he just write the words, "So it goes," which he did with a slight smile. If you're a Vonnegut reader, you know what that's about. If not, I'll explain it later. In signing my book, he also scribbled this little image right below his name that he liked to use from time to time, which for the sake of propriety and good taste, I will not explain here in terms of what it represents. You can catch me later in coffee hour on that one if you want. So what is it then with me and Vonnegut? Well, for Oakhurst, I'm very taken with how he, a professed atheist in the sense of not believing in a supreme being, was still an intensely religious issue who seemed to wrestle greatly with the idea of God. As I read through his stuff, I had to think, man, for a man who didn't believe in God, he couldn't seem to stop talking about him or her or it. I think he would make more references to God in a given speech than I generally do in 2 or 3 months' worth of sermons. And his nonfiction works, which he's published about 2 or 3 volumes in addition to the one I showed you, his nonfiction works contain a notably high number of addresses that he gave in churches, synagogues, or other religious gatherings or settings. And he did not usually make his God references in any dismissive or cynical way, although cynicism is part of his stock in trade in his writings. But he made them instead in a more paradoxical sense of someone who is honestly searching for something that he thinks isn't there, but still believes that the search is worth the effort anyway. One of the paradoxes in Vonnegut's writings. So the need to search for a God who isn't there, which for Vonnegut and for me too for that matter, is really, I think, the search for a safe and spiritual home in an often rather crazy world. That is one of 3, as I count them, major motifs in Vonnegut's fiction and nonfiction alike. That's the first one, searching for a God he doesn't even believe is there but still wants to find. Second motif in his writings is this age-old problem of evil, which he saw as human destructiveness, human indifference, human greed, and needless and gratuitous human violence. Vonnegut was an avowed humanist, but at the same time could not turn his eyes away from humanity's tragic and shattered side. Again, paradoxically, his way of dealing with evil was largely through humor, often dark and sardonic humor to be sure, but very well done humor nonetheless. I don't believe I've laughed harder reading his novels than anybody else, with the possible exception of Christopher Moore, who I referred to a few weeks ago. Vonnegut's humor, then, is really a foil or a shield that he used to keep him, I think, from being overwhelmed at times by the often sad plight of humanity. And Vonnegut was a moralist. He was a moralist of the highest order. And moralists, as you probably know, even when they're right, can still be kind of insufferable. And so Vonnegut had a way of conveying his moral outrage at, excuse the sexist expression, man's inhumanity to man. He would convey his moral outrage about that with humor, I think, to guard against becoming insufferable. Third motif, Vonnegut writing, is madness or insanity. Many of his characters have a touch, and sometimes more than a touch, of madness about them. In Vonnegut's handling of them, however, they are actually persons of great virtue and innocence who come off as insane or mad because they are attempting to live out what for them is a normal life in a world often gone mad. Now, this is not exactly an original or new theme in the history of literature. You can read that anywhere from Dostoevsky's The Idiot to Forrest Gump. But Vonnegut was especially adept at using it. Vonnegut himself, in fact, had his own battles with mental illness. He was subject to deep periods of depression. In 1984, he even attempted suicide following the depths of such a period. Well, okay, I'll come back in a few minutes and pick up on some of those themes a little bit more. I think we're going to do a little bit of a timeout right now, and I'll try to give you what can only be, at this point, kind of the nickel tour of Vonnegut's life. He was born, as noted, in 1922 to a very comfortable, middle-class family of German origin right in the heart of the U.S. of A. in Indianapolis, Indiana. He went into World War II at the age of either 20 or 21 as a private in the Army. He was later captured and made a prisoner of war and held in Dresden, Germany. In Dresden, he and his fellow POWs were housed in an abandoned slaughterhouse, which was called Slaughterhouse 5, which later became the title and the basis for his signature novel and was also made into a motion picture. After the war, he attended a number of colleges and universities. I don't believe he graduated from any one of them, although probably someone brought him back for an honorary degree. And he eventually wound up as a public relations man for the General Electric Corporation in Schenectady, New York. which later became the city of Ilium, New York, when he began writing some of his novels. In the late 1940s, early 50s, he began getting some of his short stories published in magazines like the Saturday Evening Post, Collier's. Eventually, that allowed him to quit his job at GE and write full-time, which he did for the rest of his life. He had two marriages. His first wife tragically died of cancer, several children, including a son, Mark Vonnegut, who is now a well-known and highly respected pediatrician in the Boston area. Well, that all sounds pretty straightforward, middle class, almost kind of white bread, sort of American existence. There's none of this Kerouacian wandering around the country dead broke and getting dead drunk and then, you know, banging out novels. Where then did all of these dark humor dealings with humanity's inhumanity, among many other things, come from? Well, a lot of it stems from the instance I just alluded to. When he was an American prisoner of war in Slaughterhouse 5 in Dresden, he was there, an American soldier of German descent, when his own country, for reasons that have never really been revealed, bombed the purely civilian target city of Dresden, had no military or strategic value at all. Since the slaughterhouse facility where Vonnegut, remember, he's only about 21, 22 years old at this point, since that slaughterhouse facility where he was being held was underground, he was not harmed by the bombs, but he and his fellow POWs were given the job of cleaning up the city and carting off the hundreds of civilian dead once that raid was over. And this is how David Goldsmith, one of Vonnegut's biographers, describes the effect of all this on the kid soldier from Indiana. Planes from his country did the bombing, and he, perpetrator, observer, and target all at the same time, survived. The Dresden bombing, senseless and nightmarish, spelled doom for the comfortable, middle-class ideologies of his Indianapolis upbringing. Still another definer for Vonnegut, and he parallels Allen Ginsberg on this one, was his mother's mental illness. While Kurt was growing up, his mother would have these fits of uncontrollable screams from time to time and hurl accusations at his father. His aforementioned son, Mark, suffered a complete schizophrenic break in the early 1970s, while living on a commune in British Columbia. Mark would later write a book about that experience called The Eden Express. So, kind of beneath this covering, or maybe veneer if you want to call it, of middle-class security and living and life that you see in Vonnegut, there was these encounters he had with madness. Madness on a massive scale, having to do with his memories of Dresden. Madness more close to home, with the madness of his mother, and for a time that of his son. And the sense of the tragedy gained when I say he lost his first wife to cancer. Well, out of all this come the heroes of some of his novels. They are innocents, holy innocents, so to speak, searching for meaning, searching for God, if you will, in the midst of a world they have a hard time understanding. That gives us Billy Pilgrim in Slaughterhouse 5. It gives us Elliot Rosewater in God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater. It gives us William Niles Rumford in Cat's Cradle and the like. They are all pilgrims, as in Billy Pilgrim, in a strange and often seemingly senseless land looking for a spiritual home. I've already referred to it several times now, so I'm going to focus in on Slaughterhouse 5 because it does pull together a lot of these themes. It also has a science fiction component to it that Vonnegut wrote in, a mode he wrote in quite often. I can't begin to deal with all of his writing, so I'm just going to pick Slaughterhouse 5 and go with that for a couple minutes. Central character, as I already said, is Billy Pilgrim of Ilium, New York. He's a solid citizen, he's a dentist, he's a president of a local Rotary Club, has a wife, son, daughter. And like his creator, Billy is a World War II vet and a former POW and a survivor of the Dresden bombing. Billy is a pilgrim. He is, as they say in the novel, unstuck in time. He goes back and forth between his security and placidity of Ilium, and then he goes to Dresden. He can't stay in any one place at any one time. He moves, that is to say, between sanity and order and security, the kind of lives most of us want to live, and a certain kind of madness. But there's a third place that Billy also gets to go to, or gets carried off to or transported off to in these unstuck in time travels. And that's a planet called Tralfamador. It's a planet completely outside of time, and from which it gives him a different perspective on time and on life and death and good and evil here on Earth. And while Billy is on Tralfamador, he gets to, he gets to consort with this blue movie kind of softcore porn actress who also is unstuck in time. Her name is Montana Wildhack. And from outside of the time perspective, Billy and Montana can sit up there on Tralfamador and see life outside of time on Earth. And Billy can see and participate in any part of his earthly life that he wants to, whether it's Ilium or Dresden or anything else. He even gets to see, Billy gets to see how and when he dies. And he can go to that time and place anytime as well. Now remember, Billy is a wholly innocent. So he tries to write a letter to the editor in his hometown of Ilium to explain this kind of time traveling he's doing and what it's like up there on Tralfamador. Writes a letter to the editor which goes, "All moments," says in part, "all moments, past, present, and future, always have existed, always will exist. Now, the Tralfamadorians can look at all the different moments just the way we can look at the stretch of the Rocky Mountains, for instance. They can see how permanent all the moments are, and they can look at any moment that interests them. It's just an illusion we have here on Earth that one moment follows another like beads on a string, and once the moment is gone, it's gone forever. When a Tralfamadorian sees a corpse, all he thinks is that the dead person is in a bad condition at that particular moment. But that same person is just fine in plenty of other moments. Now when I hear someone is dead, I simply say what the Tralfamadorians say about dead people, which is, so it goes." Okay, so what's going on here? Of course, the people at the newspaper say with that story, they're deciding he really is mad. Kind of keep an eye on him for the rest of the time. But what's going on here? The best way for me to answer that is to say that what goes on for me when I read something like this. And here's what I see. I see that there is a tension, a necessary tension, I believe, between caring deeply and passionately about someone or something or certain principles and values, caring very intensely about all that on the one hand, while also being able to say at times, so it goes. I care about a lot of things, as I know each of you do as well. I also know that caring can be consuming. It can be consuming if one is not careful to the point of there being no you left to care. At times I have to let go of it in order to re-engage. It's a matter of needing to say, so it goes, once in a while, in order to be able to jump back into this sometimes mad and yet sometimes very blessed world in which we all live and move and have our being. I also think Tralfamador is a metaphor for the god Vonnegut's son. This god is not a supreme being, or not a being, supreme or otherwise, and is not found in a place, heaven or otherwise. It is rather instead a perspective, a cosmic perspective. A way of looking at all the different moments just the way we look at the stretch of the Rocky Mountains. What Vonnegut is aiming for here, I think, is a transcendent way or view of looking at life. It's a view that takes the present very seriously, but also says, this is not all there is about me or about my life. It's a way of seeing one's life as a totality that can be affirmed, even in those particular moments, when all one can say is so it goes. So Vonnegut's God's eye view of the universe then is a place where everything, that is everything, is finally all right. In the preface to Fate's Worse Than Death, the book I started off with, Vonnegut reprints an interview he gave for the British Weekly Guardian. And in that interview, he's asked, What is your idea of perfect happiness? The answer: imagining that something, somewhere, wants us to like it here. Imagining, please note, imagining that something, somewhere, wants us to like it here. Later in the interview, kind of follow-up questions, asked, when were you at your happiness? And he answers with this very short story. About 10 years ago, my Finnish publisher took me to a little inn on the edge of the permafrost in his country, which I assume was Finland. We took a walk and found frozen ripe blueberries on bushes. We thawed them out in our mouths. It was as though something somewhere wanted us to like it here. That was an eternal moment for Vonnegut. In the Trofamadorian sense, it was a moment as full and real and happy for Vonnegut as had been those horrifying times in Dresden, or the time of the madness of his son, or the time when he lost his wife to cancer. He still kept imagining that something somewhere wanted him to like it here. That's a perspective and a life stance that I try to maintain for myself. Well, time to wrap this up. I try to imagine how Vonnegut would like having such a sermon as this one delivered about him. All I've been able to do is give you a smattering of his life and work. You'll have to read it yourself if you really want to get it as to what he's trying to say, and I'm not completely sure I ever completely get him myself. But there he is. Humanist. An atheist who still talks a lot about God. He stated in various times that he placed his highest value and takes his personal moral code from Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. He even, in the back of Fate's Worse Than Death, he even wrote a mass in the appendix to this book. He loved and cared deeply for and about the peoples of this planet, as well as the planet itself, while also laughing at all of it at times. And finally, I try to imagine how, writing in that flat and sometimes sardonic, kind of straight on descriptive style of his, which you never really know whether he's got his tongue in his cheek or not, you've read it, you know what I mean. I try to imagine how, in his style, he would describe this setting, right here and right now. Say if he was looking on from out there on Trofamador, or wherever he is at this point. I'm going to give it a shot. I don't know if I'm channeling Vonnegut here or not, but I'll give it a shot. In a Unitarian Universalist church in Nashua, New Hampshire, USA, planet Earth, on an early Sunday morning in May of 2007, a minister did a sermon about me. It could have been better, but it was okay. The church had large paper butterflies attached to its walls. They were pretty, really. The minister was doing a sermon about me. He said, I have died. So it goes. And so we go, and so go our lives. And from his place on Trofamador, or wherever he may happen to be, I don't think Kurt Vonnegut would mind if I paraphrase one of the titles of his novels and end this by saying, God bless you, Mr. Vonnegut. Let's sing our closing hymn together. Here it is. Standing.